This one is for Steve Post. Stay tuned for The Turning Point. There's an international organization called Oxfam that is a sort of a social service economics agency that measures income in the world, economics, poverty, things like that. This is from a recent article in the New York Times. They estimate that the richest 85 people in the world, let me say that again, the richest 85 people in the world own half of all the wealth in the world. There are 7 billion people on the planet. Too many, yes. 7 billion people, some of whom might be you. If you're listening, you're one of them. One of them is me. Some of them are there are people out there in the radio, the luxurious radio studios of PRN. There are 7 billion people on the planet. 85 human beings in the world own half of all the wealth. Okay. The other day in the New York Times, you notice the New York Times is the paper I read. I guess you picked that one up because you're smart. Had a front page color picture, and it is a picture of the Pope in the Vatican workers' cafeteria. And he is sitting there, doesn't show what he's eating, but he lined up, got his lunch, sat down, and ate with them. And it says, Pope Francis had lunch with Vatican workers on Friday after he walked into the cafeteria unannounced and lined up tray in hand. A cashier told Vatican newspaper, L'Osservatore Romano that she didn't have the courage to hand him his bill. Well, he could probably afford it. In any case, now, the first thing you think of is, did he know? I mean, everybody in the world has got a camera now, right? Anybody who's got a smartphone or an iPod or anything has got a camera or a moving picture, you know, camera or a still camera. So maybe somebody just, it looks as if somebody just snapped it because it doesn't have a professional look to it. He is not the kind of person probably who cares or knows. I'm sure he knows, but he probably doesn't care if everybody's going to take his picture or not. He just does what he does. And when I look at this picture, it has the same effect on me that it has on a lot of other people. This is really something. You know, the Times prints things all over the place, and newspapers print things all over the, you know, all over the place, and they call it news, but it's not always news. It's news that this guy walked in unannounced, stood in line, got his tray, sat down with these people, that somebody took his picture. It would have been better if nobody took his picture, of course, because then what a lot of people are saying and what some of my people on my mailing list told me when I mentioned this to, on a message on my mailing list said, he just knows a good photo op when he sees one. You know what? I don't think so. I think this is just the way he is. But and you keep hearing about this guy all the time. Well, you know, Pope Francis, what an actual Christian this guy seems to be. And like I say, there are other people, usually a lot of ex-Catholics, who had to put up with the misery and brutality and the hypocrisy of the Catholic Church when they were growing up. They think it's just good salesmanship on his part. All these measures and moves he's taking and the way he's acting humble and telling people that, I mean, in one case he told some people that they had to close down a fancy, very high-level, luxurious hotel on the grounds of the Vatican, which was housing who knows who, you know, like celebrities or rich people that came to visit to see him or just to make money. And they close it down and, you know, use it for a shelter for the poor. So, and he does these kinds of things all the time. And before he was the Pope, when he was the Archbishop, I guess he was the Cardinal. When he was the Cardinal in Argentina, in Buenos Aires, he was still doing the same thing. So he hasn't ever really changed. But it's funny when I look at the Pope and I think of, and if you just say the word the Pope, to me, this picture and the picture of the Pope and the idea of the Pope is at once sort of ludicrous and silly to me and also frightening at the same time. And this is because I'm Jewish. And I don't know what the Pope means to people who are Catholic or to anybody else, but I know that to a lot of people, maybe in my generation or, you know, maybe later on, but certainly people in my generation who grew up in the 50s and 60s, and this is right after World War II, and grew up in neighborhoods in New York City where they used to call New York City all the time a melting pot, but if it was a melting pot, the stuff in the pot never melted. It just stayed in separate chunks. And if one chunk banged into another one, there was trouble. So, and Catholics were the most trouble for Jews when I was growing up. And the Pope was the symbol of all that was Catholic, obviously. When I was growing up, all Christians were seen as somehow foreign and strange and possibly threatening and even dangerous. And we got a lot of this from my, you know, my grandmother's generation. My grandmother's generation were people who all came over here from Eastern Europe and had to put, and from Central Europe and other places in Europe, and had to put, mostly Eastern Europe though, and had to put up with the depredations, the torture, the insanity, the murder, the rapes, and the imposed poverty and bigotry and anti-Jewish laws and rules of places like Poland and especially Russia. And then when I was growing up, then there had been the Holocaust, which in a way you can't pin on the Pope, but the Pope at the time was Pope Pius, and he was the Pope when I was a kid. Pope Pius, before he became pope, and I forget when it was, in the late 30s, maybe? It was in the late 30s. He had been the papal nuncio, that is to say, the ambassador from the Vatican to Nazi Germany. And he got along just swell with them. And there's lots of accusations that the church did not do enough, or all that it could, or order all of its people, or certainly he never made any statements. I guess he was afraid that Mussolini's government, or certainly the Germans, when they took over Italy, I think it was in 43, would ransack the Vatican or burn it down or lock him up or stick all the people in the Vatican in concentration camps. So maybe he was just plain scared. But whatever it was, he never really made any speeches in the 30s and the 40s talking about how outrageous it was and how wrong it was and how they should stop acting the way they should, the Nazis. So Pope Pius was not anybody that was that endeared the Catholic Church to Jews in my neighborhood. And so we grew up with the Holocaust and World War II and the Nazis. And when you think about it, or when I think about it anyhow, maybe other people would make this comparison, but this kind of mass murder that went on throughout history of the Jews, a lot of the times orchestrated by the Catholic Church and by local Catholic churches, by the Vatican, and by certainly Eastern Orthodox and Russian Orthodox Church. All of this stuff, really, when you look at what the Nazis did, it's just a natural outcome. Martin Luther was incredibly anti-Semitic. And when you look at what the and most of the Germans were Lutherans, the ones that weren't Catholic. So when you look at what the Nazis did to somebody like me who reads history and maybe, again, from the Jewish filter, it's all a natural progression. It's all a natural progression. So, the Inquisition and the Eastern Orthodox Church, pogroms, Cossacks, murder, torture, rape, mass exile of Jews from various countries. And the Nazis, it's all the same. It was all the same thing to us. And when I was growing up, there was a lot of anti-Semitism in the 50s out. And this is at the edge of the city. This wasn't in the, in the inner city where there was always, the Crips and the Bloods, whoever the version was then, the Jews, the Irish. But when I was growing up, it was a kind of a idyllic little quiet neighborhood that we lived in called Laurelton out in Queens, which was at the edge of the city. And there was another town further on that was part also of the city. It was on a parallel line with us right before it all turned into Nassau County, which was not part of New York City. And that's where most of the Irish live. And in my neighborhood, there were Italians and Jews. And in the next neighborhood over was the Irish. They were all anti-Semitic, but the worst were the Irish. The worst were the Irish. The Irish Catholics. The Irish Catholics were the worst. They were a lot of them. They'd come over to our neighborhood, and they'd during high holidays, during Yom Kippur, they were on Rosh Hashanah. They would stand outside the synagogue and yell things. They would catch you during Easter, especially. They would catch you in the playground and try to beat you up. Christ killer, they would say. What does that mean to a 10-year-old kid? And I was 10 years old in 1955. What does that mean to me? Christ killer? Something that happened 2,000 years ago? Impossible to put these things together. I go to my grandmother. I said, what is this all about? Fortunately, I was I had two responses to this kind of behavior, to this kind of approach when some beefy, half-drunken Irish kids would come over. And the priests and the nuns set them on during Easter. Now, I'm sure this doesn't happen anymore, or I doubt it happens any place, of course. I think it would be outrageous to imagine that it would still happen. But in the 50s, it was not unusual that during Easter, when during the whole Easter holiday, when Christ was crucified, and, a couple of thousand, all of this, it could be pure mythology for who knows, but when Christ was crucified, and the priests, the high priests, the Jewish priests of Palestine wanted him out of the way. This is the mythology. This is the story anyhow. And maybe they set on some Jews in the street because Christ claimed he was the Messiah. And the Jews have the ancient tradition of the Messiah. The Messiah would come and he would be the savior of the Jews. and then maybe by extension the savior of the human race, but certainly the savior of the Jews. Christ claimed he was the Messiah, but he didn't have the attributes that are laid down, I don't know what it is, in the Torah or in the Talmud or both, of what the Messiah was supposed to be like. So a lot of average Jews considered this to be sheer blasphemy, and they hated him for it, following in line with a kind of ignorant bigotry of all fundamentally religious people. And I don't mean people who are pious or religious in any way, but fundamentalists, right? So who knows? Yes, the Jews were partially responsible for urging on the Romans to crucify him, although the Romans needed no excuse to crucify anybody. But during Easter, what would happen when I was a kid, and this happened year after year after year, I mean, and, you know, it just never stopped until way into the 60s, for another reason I'll mention, that they would show up and outside the synagogue, throw a rock. The one time they threw a rock through the window of the synagogue, it was always the Irish. They were, I have to say it, you know, this is from my childhood. They were the most belligerent, ignorant, bigoted, and stupid people in my entire neighborhood. And they would be set on. I mean, maybe they just need an excuse to be violent, because they grew up in, a lot of these guys grew up, these kids grew up, Irish kids grew up in households where there was a lot of bad corporal punishment. There was, there was sons of firemen and cops, and there was drinking in some of the houses. And they would go into these churches, and they I don't think they really necessarily believed it, but they bought it because it was an excuse to go beat up on somebody weaker than them. So they didn't ever bother the Italians, but they bothered the Jews, because the Jews were not brought up to be violent for long historical and religious and other reasons. Not that they couldn't have been. There was plenty of tough Jews in my neighborhood. One example was one time when I was about 12 years old, we were inside the synagogue, and it was during one of the holiest days of the year, and during Easter, it was Passover. It was during Passover, and which occurs at the same time of Easter, as Easter, of course, because it is the same holiday, really, in a way. It all occurred at the same time. So the priests and the nuns had preached to them that the evil, vicious Jews had murdered or urged the murder of their Lord. And it was very clear, it was made very clear by the nuns and the priests, all of whom we Jews detested because of this, the pestilential descendants of these same evil Jews are right over there in that neighborhood. You could just go find a synagogue. You could find any one of them. They're responsible. I was responsible at the age of 10 in 1955 for the murder of Christ. Lenny Bruce made a joke about this once, and Jews all know about this, like they're responsible for the murder of Christ, even if it's 1941 or 1958 or 1962, right? And he said, but it's true, Lenny Bruce says, it's true. Actually, the Jews did kill Christ. And the reason I notice is that when my Uncle Morty died, he left a note in the basement and said, yeah, we did it. So 10 years old, they're catching me on the playground and trying to beat me up. My response to it was, depending on what mood I was in, it was throw a rock-hard basketball, playground basketball, and break the nose of one kid once when I was about 12 or 13. And another time, which seemed to frighten him off. And another time, I just took off and started running, and they couldn't catch me because most of them were overweight. And this is what it was like growing up. And all the cops in my neighborhood, of course, were Irish. Every last cop in the city seemed to be Irish if they weren't Italian. But they were all Irish. And the politicians, mostly Irish, which had been a long tradition in New York all the way since the 1860s and 70s. And they sort of ran everything up until the 40s and 50s when just by sheer weight of numbers and by monetary contributions, the Jews managed to elbow their way in. And they became the politicians then, too, along with the Irish. But when I was growing up, for instance, there was a mayor called Mayor Wagner, who was the mayor of New York City, an Irish guy, for 12 straight years. And so we just said mayor. He was a mayor the whole time. So it's like when you say Mayor Wagner, that's what the mayor's name was, Mayor Wagner. It was the title, Mayor Wagner. And when another mayor got elected, we didn't really understand. Is he the new Mayor Wagner? So Anyhow, this is what this is how we grew up. And of course, a lot of the Jews felt that the rituals, and we stayed away from churches. We didn't go near any churches. This is most like I say, because my best friend was a Southern Baptist, but that was freakish in my neighborhood. Jews hung out with Jews, Christians hung out with Christians. And usually, depending on what sect it was, Methodists were with the Methodists, Lutherans with the Lutherans. But basically, Christians hung out with Christians. And the Christians never entered a synagogue, because that's where the evil Jews were, with the, you know, the devil's tail between their legs and the horns and all their international money, where they controlled everything that went bad in the Christian's life. And so they would never go even near a synagogue. And as far as Jews were concerned, it was exactly the same thing. We would cross the street. If we were walking on a street where there was a church, especially a Catholic church, we would cross the street. To even walk near a church, let alone to stand in front of it, let alone the unthinkable, to go in a church because you had a friend was there or because you were curious or anything, you could lose your soul. You could lose your poor Jewish soul by walking into a church. They would steal it from you. So it wasn't in a way too different than minus the violence and minus the aggression. It wasn't really too different than the way the Christians, especially the Catholics, felt about synagogues. At one time, a bunch of Irish kids, maybe 10, 15 Irish kids, beefy, stupid, during Easter, upset because we had murdered me and my mother and my little sister and my grandmother and some other people had actually murdered Christ, which was, you know, that's pretty heavy for a bunch of people who really didn't bother people too much. But We had to do it. What can I tell you? You know, I mean, put me on the witness stand. So what can I say? So we murder. So they show up outside the synagogue, and it's during Passover. A rock comes through the window. A rock comes through the front window of the synagogue. Can you believe this? These were different times, and this was different circumstances. The Irish kids here weren't dealing with cowering, scared to death Jews in Russia and Poland, a lot of whom in the millions came to the United States to escape this kind of anti-Semitism, this violent, crazy anti-Semitism, where villages were burned down and other atrocities committed. These are guys, the guys in my synagogue during Passover, these guys had lived through the Depression and they had been in combat, a lot of them, in World War II. They were big, beefy guys. This is a lower middle class neighborhood and some middle class people. They had jobs like floor waxer, you know, and they carry around these heavy machines all the time. They were guys who had stores and they had to carry heavy boxes. A lot of them were shipping clerks, people like that. They were tough guys, and they had been in the war, and they had, you know, been, some of them had actually liberated concentration camps or entered concentration camps. They weren't about to listen to one more word of this stuff. They weren't going to take one more piece of crap from anybody. So the rock comes through the window. We're hearing filthy Jews, kikes, this and that and everything else. That all of a sudden, although the rabbi said, No. Let them. He got two words out of his mouth. Half of the men in the synagogue emptied out. It's 20, 30 guys emptied out and beat the living crap out of these guys. I mean, a couple of them wound up in a hospital. The cops show up. The Irish cops show up. And they, you know, they go in. They say, break it up, break it up. And they say, what happened? And rabbis out there and the head of the congregation, the president of the local congregation, he says, these guys are throwing a rock through the window and they're yelling kike and everything else. And the Irish cops picked them up and threw them into patrol cars, locked them all up, the ones they didn't have to take to the hospital. This is what happened when I was growing up. And when I finally got to know, when I got to know people who, when I was older, in my teens and 20s, when I was always perverse anyhow, when I got to know people who were Christian and especially Catholic, I went inside churches and I was appalled by all the blood, the crucifixes, this man hanging up on a wall in a synagogue. There are no images. There are not supposed to be any images of God. There is only God. There's not Father, Son, Holy Ghost, Saint somebody or Mother Mary. There's none of that. There is only God. And God is an uncomprehendable, eternal essence, all-powerful, whatever. Some people believe benevolent, but if you believe at all, I don't know. But meanwhile, there's absolutely no images of God. There's no statues. There's no pictures. There's no drawings. But when I walked into a church, I was absolutely astounded by the by all the statues, and a lot of them, depending on what Catholic church it was, all this blood is coming out, nails through hands, nails through feet. What? I had never really seen or heard of anything like this before. After all, don't remember, Catholics, Christians were total strangers to me. We didn't really mix, except I did, with my best friend who was a Baptist, but that was a different thing. As far as the Catholics go, no, I never went to a Catholic church. And then when I talked to my friends, they would tell me, a lot of them ex-Catholics, of course, they would tell me that, not religious, they would tell me about all the rituals and how a lot of them who went to Catholic schools used to get beat up by the priests, would punch them out. Nuns would smack them with heavy rulers. Some of these rulers had those old rulers that had the metal piece of brass on the side for drawing a straight line. And they would hit them sideways with these rulers and hit them on the knuckles with the rulers and smack them. So there was corporal punishment. And then about confession, you go in and you tell somebody who's never been married, who for all anybody knows is in there jerking off. I have no idea whatsoever. These guys wearing these strange robes. You go in and you tell them has never had sex. And you go, and a lot of my friends, some girls I knew, some boys would go in and say, Father, sex this, sex that, I had impure thoughts, really? And is there a human being in the entire world who hasn't had any kind of thought? I mean, how many impure people are there in the world? 7 billion, if there are 7 billion. And then you you confess your sins, which I'm sure, in a way, has a certain lightening effect, right? I mean, it literally lightens you up. I mean, it's the same thing as therapy, in a way. I mean, you say, I did this and I did that, and I feel terrible about it. And they would say, depending on what they were like, the priests, some of them were heavy and nasty and crazy. Others were good-hearted, and they wanted people to feel better, and that's why they became priests. You know, it took longer for me to learn about the whole thing in more detail. But they would give them something, say 25 Hail Marys, this with the rosary, that with the rosary. So, but all this stuff about crossing yourself and confession and all these bleeding statues, to us, it was completely nuts. It was all absurd. It was the silliest thing we ever saw in our lives. Naturally, of course, all the Jewish ritual and Latin. Why were they talking in an ancient dead language? But the idea, of course, for the Jews, talking in Hebrew, of course, Israel used Hebrew, but talking in Hebrew and wearing special costumes and touching, the fringe of the Torah and, all kinds of rituals and all kinds of, special dietary laws that we had, that's okay. But the Catholic Christian stuff, that was really crazy.
I used to be Irish Catholic. Now I'm an American. You grow. Yeah. I was from one of those Irish neighborhoods in New York, one of those kind of parish schools. It wasn't typical. It was Corpus Christi was the name of it. It could have been any Catholic church, right? Our Lady of Great Agony. St. Rita Moreno. Our Lady of Perpetual Motion. What's the difference? What's the surprise? The church part and the neighborhood part were typical, but the school was not. It wasn't one of those old-fashioned parish kind of prison schools with a lot of corporal punishment and systematic discipline with the steel ruler, right? Oh, my hand! Oh! And you'd fall 2 years behind in penmanship, right?
Well, he's behind in penmanship, Mrs. Carlin. I don't know why.
He's crippled. He's trying to learn to write with his left hand. We didn't have that. We got, somehow I got lucky, you know, got into a school where the pastor was kind of into John Dewey and progressive education, and he talked the parish, talked the diocese, rather, into experimenting in our parish with progressive education and whipping the religion on us anyway and see what would happen with the two of them there. And worked out kind of nice. There was a lot of classroom freedom. There was no, for instance, there were no grades or marks, you know, no report cards to sweat out or any of that. There were no uniforms. There was no sexual segregation, boys and girls together. And the desks weren't all nailed down in a row, you know. They were movable desks, and you had new friends every month. It was nice. Like I say, a lot of classroom freedom. In fact, there was so much freedom that by eighth grade, many of us had lost the faith. Because they made questioners out of us, and they really didn't have any answers, you know. They'd fall back on, well, it's a mystery.
Oh, thank you, Father. Mystery? I don't know. What's he talking about? Mystery.
Part of class clown was being an imitator, as you probably noticed. But I used to imitate the priests, which was right on the verge of blasphemy, you know. I could do them all rather well. I did Father Byrne the best. Father Byrne was the one who used to celebrate the children's mass. I always thought that was great, to celebrate mass.
Yeah, man.
Father Byrne did the children's mass, did the sermon every week. He used to do parables about Dusty and Buddy. Dusty was a Catholic, and Buddy was not. And Buddy was always trying to talk Dusty into having a hot dog on Friday.
Well, it seems we have time for one more, and this is one I always like to close with. Recently, there has been a great deal of ferment in the Roman Catholic Church involving more liberal changes. In particular, they have permitted the use of vernacular language instead of Latin in portions of the Mass. They have made optional the eating of meat on Friday. This pleased me very much because I've always felt there was a basic inconsistency in the church dogma there. You see, it was all right for a soldier to kill a man on Friday, but it was a sin to eat him. So, also, they have permitted the use of some secular music in portions of the liturgy. And I think that last was a particularly good idea. It inspired me with the thought that if they really want to sell what they have to sell, what they should do is redo some of the liturgical music in real popular song forms. So I tried one with the ragtime form, and it is called the Vatican Rag. First you get down on your knees, fiddle with your rosaries, bow your head with great respect, and genuflect, genuflect, genuflect. Do whatever steps you want if you have cleared them with the pontiff. Everybody say his own, Kyrie eleison, doing the Vatican Rag. Processional, step into that small confessional. There, the guy who's got religion will tell you if your sin's original. If it is, try playing it safer. Drink the wine and chew the wafer. 2, 4, 6, 8. Time to transubstantiate us. So get down upon your knees, fiddle with your rosaries, bow your head with great respect, and genuflect, genuflect, genuflect. Make a cross on your abdomen. When in Rome, do like a Roman. Ave Maria, gee, it's good to see you. Getting ecstatic and sort of dramatic and doing the Vatican Rag.
Tom Lehrer. Did you ever hear Tom Lehrer stuff? Go to YouTube and put in Tom Lehrer and listen to his stuff. It's incredible. He was on TV. He's a guy who graduated from Harvard and very bright, very intelligent, and very funny. He was on some show. I forget what he was on. Something called, maybe he was on Laughing or the Smothers Brothers or some show like that way back. It was in the 60s and maybe in part of the 70s. That's where Carlin started out, too. And he mentioned when he was talking right before he started playing the Vatican Rag that there was some liberalization of the Catholic Church. And I think this was probably during the time of of Pope John the 23rd. I mean, you know, I can't always get the numbers right. Sometimes it's Napoleon the 28th, but this is Pope John the 23rd, who a lot of Catholics remember fondly as being a liberator in the Catholic Church. I think he called it liberation theology. Of course, women still not allowed, you know, and a million other things. But he did all kinds of loosening of the rules, changing things, making it less frightening, maybe fewer ways that you could have a sin. There's a million, if you're a Catholic, there's a million ways you can have a sin. But that's not so different than Muslims and Jews, believe me. If you're a Jew, you're a Muslim, there's also a million ways you can have a sin. When I was growing up and I was a kid, the worst sin you could possibly commit was not being nice to your mother and doing whatever she told you. That was, what did you say to your mother? That was, for that, you would go to hell, except the Jews didn't have hell. And that's another thing about the Catholics. They were really worried about going to hell. The Catholic kids I knew were worried that if they did one of a million things wrong, if they had meat on Friday and I don't know what, they could go to hell and burn forever for having, a fish stick like a hamburger on Friday. I mean, just seemed nuts to us. But this Pope John the 23rd, I remember that I was working in the welfare department. It was 1966 or 67. Was it Pope John the 23rd? Was he in there then? And he was getting some renown for loosening up the reins of the Catholic Church and for changing things. And he made an official pronunciation. I forget it was Papal Bull or whatever he said. You know, the Pope is the Lord's, or is it Jesus's spokesperson on earth? He has direct contact with Jesus or God. I forget which, or both. I think it's Jesus. And he said that officially he forgave the Jews. It was under this, I was working in the office and somebody had the radio on, and there was a couple of Jewish people in this unit I was working in, and it said, the Pope has announced that it no longer doctrinally, it no longer officially considers the Jews responsible for the death of Jesus. So, man, that's a load off. I feel so much better. I feel so much better because I was on probation, you know, for 1,500 years. So meanwhile, he let us off the hook. But this Pope, Pope Francis, appears to be the real deal. He really does appear to be the real deal. Like that, what I mean to say is, he actually seems like a Christian in the sense of the original Christ. And I don't mean everything afterwards in the New Testament, but I mean in the five Gospels, not all that stuff that Paul put in. Paul actually created the Catholic Church, but he does seem much like a Christian. But he has a lot to make up for. I mean, the Catholic Church has a history which is maybe worse than any other organization. I mean, I'm sorry to put these comparisons to people who respect the church or have a love for the church, but loving Christianity or loving Christ and having respect for Christ or believing in Christ is different than admiring the Catholic Church. Catholic Church has a history just about as bad as any organization in the history, recorded history of human beings. Inquisition, the mass murder of people, millions and millions and millions of people tortured and killed and burned at the stake for not having the right attitude about the Catholic Church, having blasphemed, having done something that the people who ran, a lot of these countries were run by the Catholic Church. Catholic Church once had its own army. The Catholic Church influenced and started wars. The corruption, the hypocrisy throughout history. Pope Pius, as I mentioned, during the war, and whenever a place like Portugal or Spain went to some country, took it over and murdered the inhabitants or enslaved the rest or stole everything that was there, on the beach, when they first set foot on the beach, was a conquistador, you know, somebody with a sword and armor, and right next to them, a Catholic priest representing the Catholic Church. And they condoned all this, all the slavery and the murder in the New World. Forced conversions of hundreds of thousands of people. And, of course, we had a cardinal in New York City at the time of the Vietnam War, when we were all fighting against the Vietnam War. A Cardinal Spellman, his name was. And he was cardinal for a long time. And aside from his little side habit of having chorus boys up to his mansion, of course, he lived in a mansion. All cardinals lived in mansions, gigantic mansions. So they could be archbishops or cardinals or some monsignors. They would live in these big houses, sometimes literally palaces and mansions throughout history, way up into the 20th century. Even up until now, some of them live in these things. Surrounded by parishioners who barely have enough to eat, who are eating dog food, who can't pay the rent, who have rats running through their apartment, but they're, you know, loyal Catholics. So it's a tremendous amount of stuff to make up for this. And then, of course, the hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years of rape and molestation by priests, some of whom went on to be probably cardinals themselves, but who knows who they are. Hundreds of thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of innocent children made crazy and miserable for most of their lives, girls and boys, especially a lot of boys, by priests who were perverted themselves. The sexual molestation, which is still being revealed all over the world. The church is practically bankrupt from this, as they should be. And they they are discovering more of this all the time. So this is what the new Pope has to make up for. Except, like I say, I think a lot of people think he's the real deal. There was an article. I don't know if I have time to read it all. How much time do we have there? Okay. When Pope Francis was made Pope, when he was the Cardinal of Buenos Aires, and Cardinal of Argentina. There was an article in, I think it's a South America, could have been Central America or South American newspaper, I don't remember now, that a listener, a regular correspondent of mine sent to me, who's, I guess he considers himself a member of the, well, I shouldn't really say, I don't know how religious he is, but he's one of my more intelligent, observant, and more responsive listeners. And he sent me an article that he found. This is right after Francis was made Pope, and it says, Francis the Slum Pope, Jorge Mario Bergoglio, remembered for ministering to Buenos Aires' poorest. For more than a billion Roman Catholics worldwide, he's Pope Francis. For Argentina's poorest citizens crowded in misery villages throughout the capital, he's proudly known as one of their own, a true slum pope. There is one slum that is so dangerous, it's called here Villa 2124, that most outsiders don't dare enter, but residents say that Bergoglio often showed up unannounced to share laughs and sips of mate, the traditional Argentine herbal tea, used by groups using a common straw. People here recall how the Buenos Aires Archbishop, ditched a limousine and would arrive on a bus to their little chapel, and how he sponsored marathons and carpentry classes, consoled single mothers, and washed the feet of recovering drug addicts, how he became one of them, one of the people who reside in the slums. Quote, 4 years ago, I was at my worst and needed help. When the mass started, he knelt down and washed my feet. It hit me hard. It was such a beautiful experience, said Christian Marcelo Reynoso, a garbage collector trying to kick a cocaine addiction through the church's rehab program. Long after he became cardinal in 2001, this prince of the church wore a simple black T-shirt with a white collar. For many at the slums, Cape Cacupe, I apologize profusely for my mispronunciation, Cacupe, Virgin of the Miracles Church, it's nothing short of a miracle that their friend is the Pope. He was always part of our slum, housewife Lydia Valdivieso, 41, said after praying while resting her palm on a statue of St. Expeditus, patron saint of urgent and impossible causes. Her 23-year-old son has cerebral palsy and is learning carpentry at the church's technical school. When I heard the news, I couldn't believe it. Having a Papa Valero, slum pope, is the most beautiful thing that can happen to us. I still remember him going on long walks through our muddy streets or talking to the children. Cameras followed Bergoglio once as he washed the feet of 12 young men at a rehab center. Then he kept coming back, taking confession and counseling them, one priest said. On the priest's desk lay a newspaper with a huge one-word headline, Francisco. You can tell that the church is going to change, the priest said. In fact, that he chose the name Francisco says it all. Let's stop messing around and devote ourselves to the poor. That was St. Francis's message now, and Francisco can live it. The Pope's sister, Maria Elena Bergoglio, said she is very confident that the pomp and protocol of the Vatican won't dent his lifelong humility. His message to Argentines to spend their money on charities instead of for trips to Rome to see his installation in the Vatican on Tuesday is a strong sign that he won't change, she said. That message makes me feel like he is still on the same path and he hasn't been affected. There is no worse poison than power, but he will be probably immune to it. She added that her brother's preference is for the poor, the weakest, the old, children. He has a clear preference for the poor, she said. So it really does sound like this guy is the real thing. Now, you have to think about all the politics involved. I mean, there are other cardinals in South and Central America, or maybe in Mexico, that that the old men who run the Catholic Church could have picked. I mean, their last cardinal was one of the strictest, one of the strictest popes that they had at a long, long time, so that they would flip over and pick, you know, another one that is truly heartfelt man, a Christian. Why did they do this? Now, a lot of people are cynical and say, well, they did it because they know that that is where their most loyal religious, the largest number of their most loyal religious followers are, is in Mexico, Central America, and South America. You're talking about several hundred million. There's about a billion Catholics estimated in the world. I mean, it's like they say Jews, you know, they're always saying in headlines, Jews throughout the world celebrate Rosh Hashanah. Well, no, not really. There are a million Catholics in the world. Well, no, not really. But nominally speaking, that they come from Catholic mothers and fathers, that they live in countries, and if you ask them what their religion is, very few of them will say atheist. They'll just automatically say Catholic, even if they don't go to church. So there's approximately a billion people estimated who are Catholics. And why not pick somebody who comes from a country, where there are, I don't know how many people are in Argentina, you know, 80 million, 100 million, where there are so many Catholics and an entire continent, and subcontinent or whatever, where there are hundreds and millions of Catholics. It's a good move, politically, people say. And also but they could have picked a different cardinal. There are many cardinals down there. They could have picked one. But they didn't. They picked him. They picked a guy who truly seems to understand what Christianity is all about and what Christ was all about. Like I say, he's been, and also because he's so, I don't know if the word humble is the right word for him, but maybe it is, because he was always so basically humble, and because he knew what his mission was, and Christ came for the poor and the miserable and the oppressed of the earth. And if you believe it, if you truly believe in that, and if you buy the whole package, he was the Son of God. But that's what he came for. He said it himself. That's what he came for. And this guy has always acted that way. And his behavior, where he is investigating the Vatican Bank, where, as I think I heard this, I don't know if it's a rumor, but he does not live in the ornate, gold-decorated, papal, emperor-like apartments, but lives in a separate house on the grounds, and where he closed down this luxurious hotel, and where he has done many other things. I don't know how long he'll last. There was one other pope in the last 30 or 40 years, I forget his name, that lasted a very short time, who was also investigating the Vatican Bank, which is a well-known front for lots of money laundering of some very nasty organizations. The Vatican Bank needs serious investigation, and it still hasn't been completely thoroughly investigated. Now, the Vatican itself has, between the land it owns and the property it owns and the stocks and the bonds and everything else, has something like, I don't know, 25, 30, 40 billion, there's all kinds of estimates, $40 billion. Now, a lot of this, you can't just, some people say, well, just get rid of it, you know, sell the whole thing and give it all away to the poor. That's what Christ said. Man comes to Christ and says, how do I enter the kingdom of heaven? Master, how do I enter the kingdom of heaven? And Christ says, this is a rich man came to him. And he said, give everything, sell everything you have, and give it all to the poor. Give the money to the poor. And that way you can enter the kingdom of heaven. And the man said, no, 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 no. No, no, I don't think so. So you, can the Catholic Church owning, you know, thousands and thousands of social service agencies and hospitals and, you know, through the various archdioceses countries all over the world, owning thousands and thousands and thousands of church properties, some large, some small, owning tens of billions of dollars in stock, which pay dividends. Now, a lot of this stuff is used to comfort people who need comforting. I mean, the hospitals, obviously, social service agencies everywhere. There are Catholic social service agencies that are supported by money from the Catholic Church. And you can't just throw it all out, the baby with the bathwater. But the main thing I think that the Church has to do, I mean, I'm not here to say what should happen, but he is embarrassing. One thing he's doing is embarrassing the bishops all over the world and cardinals. Some cardinals and bishops in the United States, many of whom live in still in mansions and huge houses like palaces, they have been embarrassed by his behavior. And they are selling large houses. They are moving out of mansions that they live in, and they are embarrassed. And as well they should be. I mean, the idea of wearing all this gold and ornate stuff and having servants and living in places where there are hundreds of millions of dollars in jewels and statues and gold. I mean, it's absurd, absolutely absurd. It's a sin, if anything was ever a sin. And the idea, but finally, the bottom line is women. What do they call the Pope? Il Papa, right? Il Papa, P-A-P-A. Until they ever can have an ill, I don't know what the Italian is, until they ever have Il Mama, the Church is doomed. The Church is completely doomed. No matter what else this guy does, no matter what kind of true, good-hearted Christian he is, they consider women evil. There are no women priests. There are certainly no women, obviously, on the College of Cardinals. It's an old men's club. It's an old boys' club. And women are literally considered the devil. Sexuality, which comes from women, it's all women's fault. And until women can become priests, until priests can get married to women, until women have completely equal say and can be part of the College of Cardinals and archbishops and everything else, until one of them becomes the Pope, then the Church is a hopelessly backward, useless organization. It has a lot to make up for, a lot to make up for, and that's the main one. I mean, Christ didn't consider women evil, did he? I don't think he did. So how did that all happen? How did that all happen? Well, there are plenty of books and plenty of ways to find that out. But the important thing is that Jesus came for the poor. Despite the package you have to buy, that he's the Son of God and you can only get to God through him, you know, give me a break. But, I mean, it seems to me that if you believe in God, God is available to every person, you know, no matter who they are and no matter where they are at any time in any place. You don't have to go through anybody. But Christ came for the poor. If you believe in it, Jesus came for the poor, the oppressed, the suffering, and the miserable. And the Church should always be for them, too. Always.
I know Jesus is on that main line. Tell him what you want. Jesus on that main line. Tell him what you want. You want. Well, the line ain't never busy.
Jesus is on that green line.